3. Royal Palace, City of Talkeera, Kingdom of Delphirak. What do you think they really want, Philip? Iris Dakin's tone was calm as she gazed across the dinner table's empty plates at her legal guardian, but the hazel eyes she'd inherited from her dead mother were darker than could have been explained solely by the lamp's dimness. Mostly, I think, what they've said, Your Highness. Philip Osgood, Earl of Corus, shrugged. Oh, I don't doubt they've got more in mind than they've actually said so far. But as far as what that more might be, your guess is almost certainly as good as mine, he said. And he meant it, too. Iris Dakin might be only 17 years old. Not quite 16 in the years of the planet upon which humanity had actually evolved, but she was scarcely a typical 17-year-old. Not even a typical 17-year-old princess. I don't expect they've issued their invitation, let's call it, because of their vast concern for Divan, though. Corus's tone was biting. He wouldn't have let anyone else hear him using it about the group of four. But neither he nor Iris had any illusions about that particular quartet, and no one else was present. At the same time, the man who had been Prince Hector of Coruscant's spymaster for so many years continued, I think it could probably be worse than it actually is. At least they're not insisting the two of you accompany me. Why should they bother to invite me, whatever their motives? Iris's face had tightened, and Corus found himself nodding in acknowledgement. He'd meant his final sentence at least partly as an attempt at humor, but he wasn't really surprised after the fact that it had fallen flat. And he no more doubted than Iris did that, as far as the group of four was concerned, she herself had very little value. Her little brother Divan was the legitimate prince of Coruscant. Even Caleb and Charlian of Caris acknowledged that much, even if he was currently in exile. But Iris, she was simply a sort of unimportant second thought. She had no intrinsic value as a political pawn in the group of four's eyes, and they certainly weren't going to waste any time worrying about what a fugitive princess in exile, subsisting solely, so far as they knew at any rate, upon the niggardly generosity of distant relatives, might think. Which was incredibly foolish of them, in Philip Osgood's opinion, no matter how reasonable they obviously thought it was. So far, anyway, it was entirely possible they would eventually learn the error of their ways. Probably quite painfully, he thought with a certain undeniable satisfaction. I'm afraid you have a point about that, from their perspective at least, he said in answer to her question. On the other hand, my own point stands, I think. If they had any immediate plans where Divan is concerned, they'd probably insist I'd drag him along as well. Despite the very real affection in which she held her guardian, and despite her own worries, Iris couldn't quite keep from grinning at Corus's sour tone. It wasn't really funny, of course. A journey of the next best thing to 9,000 miles would scarcely have been a mere jaunt in the country, even in the middle of summer. With winter coming on fast, it was going to be a highly unpleasant experience, no matter what happened. And its final stage had the potential to be actively dangerous, for that matter. You don't think it's just because of how hard the trip's going to be? She asked, indirectly voicing her own worry where Corus was concerned. No, I don't. The Earl's lips tightened, and he shook his head. Duquesne would probably worry about that, especially given Divan's age. Even Trenaire might consider it, for that matter, if only because of his awareness of Divan's potential value. I doubt it would even cross Magwer's mind to worry about dragging a 9-year-old through hip-deep snow, though. And Clinton. Corus broke off and shrugged, and it was Iris's turn to nod. Vicar Zomson Trenaire was probably as cold-blooded and calculating a chancellor as the Church of God Awaiting had ever produced in all the 9 dusty centuries since the day of creation. He was far more likely to regard Divan Dakin purely as a potential political asset than as a little boy whose father had been brutally murdered. And by all reports, Alain Maguire, the church's captain general, had about as much imagination as a worn-out boot. Expecting it to occur to him to worry about Divan would have been as foolish as it would futile. And then there was Jaspar Clinton. Iris no more doubted than Corus did that the Grand Inquisitor would simply have looked blankly at anyone who might have had the temerity to suggest he should bother his own head one way or the other about Divan's well-being. If they were contemplating any significant change in their calculations where he's concerned, they might want him in Zion where he'd be handy, the Earl continued. For that matter, I think Clinton at least would want the opportunity to impress Divan with just how serious an interest the Inquisitor and his associates take in him. He shook his head. No, I'm inclined to think it's pretty much exactly what Trenaire's message suggests it is. They want to be sure I fully understand their plans for him. And to get my own impressions of the situation in Coruscant, of course. For a moment, Iris looked as if she wanted to spit, and Corus didn't blame her a bit. I'm sure they've got better sources than I do, than we do, he said. Or, at least, that their sources can get their reports to Zion faster than our agents can get reports to us. But anything they know about Coruscant is second-hand at best, even if it is more recent than anything we've heard. I'm not surprised they'd want to pick the brain of one of your father's counselors.
Especially his spymaster's brain, you mean?
Iris's lips twitched a brief smile. It was very brief, though.
And especially now that Father's dead. No doubt they want your impression of how our people are likely to have reacted when Caleb assassinated him.
This time, Corus only nodded. He'd watched Iris Dakin grow up. In fact, as he'd once admitted to her, he'd been present on more than one occasion when her diaper had been changed. He knew exactly how close she'd been to her father. Exactly how she'd taken his murder. And although he'd tried his very best to keep her mind open to other possibilities, he knew exactly who she blamed for that murder. Personally, Corus's suspicions lay in a somewhat different direction. But there were dangers, especially for her, in laying those suspicions too plainly before her.
I'm sure that's one of the things they'll want to discuss, he agreed. At any rate, though, I think this probably means they're planning on leaving you and Divan here in Talkeira with King James, at least for the foreseeable future. It's going to take me better than 2 months just to get to Zion, and I don't have any idea how long they plan on my staying once I get there. Since I don't think they're contemplating separating me permanently from Divan, or that they're likely to be planning on sending him anywhere without me along as his guardian, that probably means they expect to leave him right here for at least 5 or 6 months. Probably longer, actually.
I can't say I'd be entirely sorry if they did.
Iris sighed and shook her head.
Neither of us really likes it here, but he needs some stability, Philip. Needs some time in one place to heal.
I know.
Corus reached across the table and patted the back of her left hand gently.
I know, and I'll do my best to convince them of that as well.
I know you will.
Iris smiled at him, hoping he didn't see the edge of fear behind her expression. She knew Philip Osgood. Despite the reputation some assigned him, she knew how loyal he'd always been to her father, and she herself trusted him implicitly. Probably more than she really ought to, she thought sometimes. Not because she thought there was truly any likelihood of his betraying her trust, but simply because, as her father had always said,
No one who sat on a throne, or who was responsible for supporting someone who did, could ever afford to completely trust anyone. But there was a reason her father had selected Corrus as her own and Divan's guardian. And part of that reason was that in Philip Osgood's case, at least, he'd set aside his own injunction against trusting too deeply.
Which is exactly why they'll try to separate us from you, if they realize the truth, Philip, she thought. For right now, they may well believe all those stories you and Father always encouraged about your own ambitions and sinister motivations. But if they ever figure out where your true loyalties lie, that you aren't prepared to cheerfully sacrifice Divan for your own advantage, or to curry favor with them, you'll become a potential liability, not an asset. And if that happens, Trenaire and Clinton won't hesitate for an instant about declaring us, or Divan at least, official wards of the Council of Vicars.
She looked across the table at him in the lamplight, studying his expression, and, for a moment at least, feeling every bit as young as the rest of the world thought she was. Wishing she were still young enough to climb up into his lap, put her head down on his shoulder, and let him hug away her fears while he promised her everything would be all right. But everything wasn't going to be all right ever again, and she knew it.
Don't let them take you away from me, Philip, she thought. Whatever else happens, don't let them take you away.
4. City of Manchir, Duchy of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
Coruscantians, citizens of Manchir, the blood of your slain prince cries out from the very stones of your city. The boots of the slaves and lackeys of the monster who shed that blood march through your streets. The voices of apostate priests speak in your churches. The defenders of the true faith are driven into silence and hiding. How much longer will you endure these insults, these affronts to both God and man? How much longer?
Patrick Henry frowned in concentration as he considered the composing stick and the current line of type. As a silversmith, he was a skilled engraver, but he'd discovered, not to his surprise, that there were very few similarities between engraving and typesetting. For one thing, he still had trouble reading the mirror-imaged letters. There was no problem identifying each letter as he took it from the proper pigeonhole of the job case, although he still had to look to be sure it was the proper pigeonhole, and it was easy enough, ahead of time, to chart out which letters had to go where on the composing stick before they were transferred to the form and bound together. But his brain still persisted in reading each word as he set up the type, and he'd discovered that it tried to trick him into reading the letters in the correct order, instead of in the reversed order they had to go into for the press. Still, it wasn't an impossible skill to acquire, and if it wasn't the same as silversmithing, there were similarities. He'd always liked the detail work, the concentration on the little things, working with metals, the fine coordination of hand and eye. The printer's was a different art, but it was still an art, and he'd found that the part of him which had never expected to become a street agitator treasured the retreat back into an artisan's role, even if it was only temporary. He reached for the next letter, and behind his focus on the task in hand, his mind was busy. This broadsheet would be transported from the carefully hidden basement press through a network of dedicated supporters. Copies of it would be tacked up all over the city by tomorrow night. Of course, parties of the city guard would be busy tearing them down by the following dawn. Not all of those city guardsmen would agree with their orders in that regard, Henry was sure of that, but they'd obey them. The Regency Council and that traitorous bastard Garvi would see to that. Henry discovered his jaw was clenching once more and ordered it to relax. It obeyed, after a fashion, and he drew a deep breath. Just thinking about Sir Corin Garvai was enough to send rage pulsing through every vein. Garvai's effortless defeat at the hands of Caleb Armagh and his army could have been put down to mere feckless incompetence. In his more charitable moments, Henry would even have been prepared to put at least some of it down to simple bad luck, or to the fact that Shan Wei looked after her own. But Garvai's decision to actually accept command of the traitorous forces prepared to do Armagh's will here in Coruscant had to make a man wonder. Had he truly been simply unlucky or incompetent, or had there been something more sinister at work? Some quiet little understanding between him and the invaders. Had his treason against Coruscant and the House of Dakin begun only after his defeat, or before it? Most of the time, Henry was willing to accept that Garvai's present position was a case of opportunism after the fact, not an indication of treason before the fact. And he'd realized, even without Father Adrian's gentle hints, that accusing Garvai and his father of having plotted with Caleb ahead of time would be premature at this point. In the fullness of time, that might change, especially as the debate over exactly whose hand had hired the assassins to strike down Prince Hector and his eldest son matured. Personally, it seemed obvious to Henry that those who'd profited the most by the prince's murder were those most likely to have planned that murder. And, taken altogether, he couldn't think of anyone who'd profited more heavily than the members of the Regency Council set up to govern the princedom according to Armagh's demands. They could call themselves Prince Divan's Council all they wanted to, but that didn't change who they truly answered to, or the fact that they'd somehow managed not simply to survive, but to come out with even more power than they'd had before. Nor did it change the supine surrender of the princedom's parliament, Henry thought, scowling down at the composing stick. He supposed it was unreasonable to expect Parliament to defy Armagh's will, as dutifully expressed through the Regency Council, with the Carizian Viceroy General Chairman and the better part of 60,000 Carizian Marines occupying Coruscant. Chairman had 20,000 of those Marines right here in Manchir, and while he'd made some effort to avoid parading them too blatantly through the streets of the city, everyone knew they were there, as did the members of the House of Knights and the House of Commons. So, no, it wasn't surprising Parliament had voted to give Armagh everything he asked for. On the other hand, there might well be a difference between what they'd voted for and what they really intended to do. By all reports, Parliament would be breaking up shortly, with all of its members returning to their homes, out from under the eye and the bayonets of the occupation. It would be interesting to see what happened then. He knew the hard skeleton of organized resistance had already come together here in Manchir, and his own contact from that skeleton assured him the same thing was happening outside the city. It remained to be fleshed out with sinew and muscle, but those other things would come in time. And not all of them from sources Henry might have expected. In fact, from a few stray words his contact had let drop, Henry strongly suspected that the resistance's leadership had already made discreet contact with several members of Parliament as well. No doubt they'd planted quite a few equally discreet seeds that would bear fruit in due time. In the meanwhile, Patrick Henry would concentrate on cultivating and fertilizing his own little plot right here in the capital. Henry was far too intent on his work to have noticed the tiny device perched in one corner of the basement ceiling. Even if he hadn't been distracted by the printing press, it was extremely unlikely he would have seen the thing. It was the next best thing to microscopically small, although even at that, it was larger than some of its still smaller brethren, and if anyone had told him what it was capable of doing, he would have dismissed the claims as something out of a fairy tale. Unfortunately for him, he would have been wrong, and later that evening, in the far distant city of Chiraeth, an Imperial guardsman, with a fierce mustache and a neatly trimmed dagger beard, leaned back, eyes closed, and rubbed the scar on his cheek with a thoughtful finger as he contemplated the imagery that tiny surveillance platform had transmitted to him.
"I'd really like to pay a visit to Master Hainry," Merlin Athrawis reflected without ever opening his eyes. "He and his friends are getting just a little bit better organized than I could wish. On the other hand, we're building up a pretty detailed organizational chart on them. Of course, it would help if we could tell someone in Coruscant that we are, but I suppose you can't have everything." He grimaced sourly at the thought, yet he also knew he was correct. He didn't like how much of his own, and Owl's, and Caleb's, and Charlian's time was being consumed by the project, but he'd spread his Snark's remote platforms thickly throughout the Coruscantian capital. As each member of the emerging resistance cadre was identified, one of the parasite platforms was assigned to him full-time, and these people's internal organization wasn't nearly as sophisticated as it could have been. Adrian Wyman, and there was someone Merlin really wanted to have a word with, had done his best to instill a cellular organization, at least at the very top. Unfortunately for him, he had to make do with what was available, and at least some of his associates were too direct for that sort of sophistication. They had far more enthusiasm than professional detachment. And, as far as Merlin could tell, very few members of the Earl of Corus's intelligence services had so far been co-opted by Wyman. "Of course, we don't know how long that's going to last, now do we?" he reminded himself. There were times when Merlin was deeply tempted to hop into his recon skimmer, buzz down to Manchir, and personally eliminate Wyman. It wouldn't be particularly difficult. In fact, it would be childishly simple, and, under the circumstances, one of the more pleasant chores he could have assigned himself. Unfortunately, unless he was prepared to remain in Coruscant full-time and spend his nights doing nothing but eliminating resistance leaders, he'd be rather in the position of King Canute. Worse, he would deprive the resistance of its organized leadership, and he didn't want that. Far better to leave Wyman in position for now, however irritatingly competent and industrious he was proving, rather than shatter the resistance's cohesion. That might change, yet for now, it was far more useful to know exactly who its leaders were, exactly where they might be found when the time came, and exactly what sort of plans it was making and what information it was passing to its various satellites. Breaking up the current organization would almost certainly deprive it of its increasing effectiveness, but only at the cost of replacing it with a formless, unorganized movement, which would be almost impossible to monitor the way they could monitor the present situation. Not to mention one which would be far more difficult to uproot when the moment to take action against it finally arrived. "I only wish," he thought, returning his attention to the Snark's imagery, "that I didn't expect them to do so much damage in the interim."
"I know it's a pain in the arse,"
Howell Cherman growled, standing with his hands clasped behind him while he gazed out his office window at a vista of cloudy rain.
"And truth to tell, what I'd really like to be doing is shooting the bastards the instant they turn up."
Brigadier Joel Johnston, commanding officer of the Imperial Carisian Marines 3rd Brigade, looked at his superior's back with a faint smile. It was mostly a smile of affection, although it might have held just a trace of amusement, and possibly just a little exasperation. If it did, though, that last emotion was directed at the situation, not at Viceroy General Cherman.
"And if the old man needs to vent his spleen at someone, I suppose I'm the logical candidate," Johnston reflected. It's not like there's anyone else he can let down his guard with.
That would probably have been true with just about any senior officer in Sherman's unenviable position, the brigadier thought. Combining the roles of Occupation Force Commander and Official Viceroy for Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian would have been a stiff enough challenge for almost anyone. Given Sherman's distaste for politics, coupled with his previous lifelong success at avoiding anything that even smacked of duty at court, it would have been difficult to find someone who felt less suited to the task. Fortunately for the Empire of Karras, it had never occurred to Howell Sherman to decline his present post. And the reason that was fortunate was that no matter how ill-suited he might have considered himself, he was almost certainly the very best man available for the job. The Viceroy General might not like politics, and he might be unpolished, to say the very least, by courtly standards. But that didn't mean he didn't understand politics, and his iron sense of duty and integrity was coupled with a bulldog pugnacity any fool could sense from clear across a room. There was no doubt that the noblemen and commoners who'd assembled in Parliament here in Manchir had sensed it, at any rate, and none of them had been stupid enough to challenge him. Not openly, at any rate. Johnston had no doubt that quite a few conversations in various cloakrooms and private apartments had centered on clandestine ways to evade Sherman's determination to enforce the policies Emperor Caleb had laid out before his own departure for Chisholm. For the moment, though, the Viceroy General had his hand firmly around the throat of Coruscant's great knights. That had been made easier by the fact that, like the wealthier members of the House of Commons, the great aristocrats had too much to lose. That made them cautious, unwilling to attempt open resistance, especially after Sherman, in his blunt, unpolished, uncourtly, yet crystal-clear style, had made it abundantly plain what he intended to do to any noble who violated his new oath of fealty to the Carisian crown. The fact that diplomatic circumlocution was so utterly foreign to him had gone a great way towards making certain no one in his audience doubted for a moment that he'd meant every word he said, and that any excuses about oaths to the excommunicated not being binding would leave him remarkably unmoved when he and his siege artillery turned up outside any oathbreaker's castle walls.
"But pain in the arse or not," Sherman continued now, swinging away from the window to face the brigadier, hands still clasped behind him. "It's the way it's got to be, for now at least," he grimaced. "Mind you, I'd like nothing better than to get my hands on the damned ringleaders. There's not much doubt in my mind that most of these poor bastards are being more or less led around by the nose."
He made a disgusted sound midway between a snort and a snarl.
"And I've read the damned broadside, same as you. Somebody's stirring this pot, and I've no doubt His Majesty was right about what it is they're after. Which is why I'm not going to give it to them."
"Yes, sir," Johnston acknowledged.
Although, truth to tell, it wasn't exactly as if he'd objected to the Viceroy General's instructions or policy. On the other hand, he was pretty sure Sherman knew he understood his superior's explanation was more in the nature of a way for Sherman to let off pressure of his own before it did him a mischief.
"The last thing we need to offer up to the bastards behind all this are martyrs," Sherman growled now, turning his head to look back at the water-streaming panes of glass. "I think most of these people are at least willing to keep their heads down, if the troublemakers will just leave them alone. I'm not saying we could keep the lid on the pot forever, but all we really have to do is keep it screwed down until Anvil Rock, Tartarian, and the rest of the Regency Council get their feet on the ground. Build up at least a little legitimacy. That business at the cathedral the other day," he turned his head back, his eyes meeting Johnston's suddenly, "that could have turned nasty. Bad enough to lose one of our own, But if that young lad of yours, Lieutenant Tallis, wasn't it?
He paused until Johnston nodded, then snorted again.
If the boy had lost control, let his men stack the bodies the way I've no doubt they wanted to, instead of settling for cracked skulls and a few broken bones, it would have given the bastards on the other side exactly what they wanted.
I've already commended Lieutenant Tallis, sir,
Johnston said, making no effort to hide how pleased he'd been by the Viceroy General's remembering the young man's name.
And I agree with what you just said. All the same, sir, if they keep pushing, and especially if we lose more men, we're going to have to push back. It's one thing to show restraint. It's another thing if the other side decides restraint is really weakness.
Agreed,
Sherman nodded grimly.
That's one reason I want Garvai's formation stood up as quickly as possible. I'd rather put a Coruscantian face on this whole confrontation, drop us back into a support role.
He showed his teeth in a thin smile.
Do you suppose any of these people are going to realize just how much we don't want to kill any more of them than we can help?
In a perfect world, sir, I'm sure they would. In the world we've got...
The brigadier shrugged, and Sherman chuckled harshly. Then he squared his shoulders and marched back across to his desk. He settled into the chair behind it and picked up the first of the folders piled on his blotter.
"Well, as you've just suggested, it's an imperfect world, Brigadier," he observed. "And that being the case, I suppose it's time we dealt with some of those imperfect little details, starting with this request from Brigadier Miles."
He tapped the top sheet of paper and the folder with an index finger.
"I think he's got a point about being spread too thin."
"I agree, sir," Johnston grimaced. "That's not to say I like it, but I agree he's got a problem. And unfortunately, I can already see where you're thinking about finding the manpower to solve it for him."
"Sharp as a tack, that's you," Sherman said,
with another, much more cheerful-sounding chuckle.
"Now, where do you think I should start robbing you?"
"Well, sir, I was thinking that if we took Alpha Company out of 2nd Battalion of the 3rd, then took Charlie Company out of 1st Battalion of 4th, we'd have a pretty good mix of experience and enthusiasm. Then, if we added..."
October, Year of God, 893. 1. Merlin Athrawus's recon skimmer, safe hold low orbit, above the anvil. Empress Charlian of Karis had been prepared for marvels, or she'd thought she was anyway. But the reality was so far beyond what she'd expected that she'd discovered all her preparations had been in vain. She sat in the recon skimmer's passenger compartment, with her nose perhaps 2 inches from the inside of the clear armor-plast which covered it, like some perfectly transparent bubble, staring out at the night-struck sky. The moon rode high and clear, shining like a new, incredibly bright silver coin against the blackest heaven she had ever imagined, spangled with stars that were even more impossibly bright than the moon. They were odd, those stars, burning with pinprick clarity, without even the faintest trace of a twinkle. She'd never seen stars that sharp, that clear, even on the coldest winter night, and she shivered as she remembered Merlin's explanation.
"We're so high there's not even any air out there. Not enough to matter anyway," she shook her head. "It never even occurred to me that the only reason they twinkle is because we're seeing them through so many miles of air that it distorts our view. I always thought clear as air meant really clear, but it doesn't really after all. And now I'm up above all of that. I'm on the very threshold of what Merlin calls space."
No other safehold-born human being she knew had ever been as high before. Not even Caleb, on his journey between Coruscant and Karis. She stared down, down to where the planet itself had become a vast, curved globe. to where the cloud tops, so very far below the skimmer, were silver and deepest black, drifting across the anvil, that stormy sweep of water between Chisholm and Hammer Island. She couldn't make out the surface from this height, not in the dark, not using her own merely mortal eyes. She knew it was there, though, and all she had to do was turn her head and look at the visual display to see that vast, wind-ruffled stretch of salt water in perfect detail. Merlin had shown her how to manipulate the display's controls, and the skimmer's computer-driven sensors happily generated daylight-bright, true-color imagery of anything she cared to gaze upon. She could focus closer, zoom in, Merlin called it, until even the most distant objects below seemed little more than arm's length away, too. And yet, as Caleb had warned her would be the case, that marvel, that God's eye view, paled beside what her own eye saw when she gazed out through the armorplast. "It's because the imagery is magic," she thought. "Merlin can call it whatever he wants, but it is magic, and my emotions know it, whatever my mind may be trying to tell them. It's like something out of a child's tale, something that's not quite real. But this, the moon, these stars, those clouds, I'm seeing them with my own eyes, and that means they are real. And I'm seeing them from thousands upon thousands upon thousands of feet in the air. I'm actually up here, flying among them, and they're really, really out there, all above and about and beneath me." She drew a deep breath, smiling more than a bit crookedly, as that thought reminded her of the previous evening. Charlian finished throwing up, she hoped, and wiped her face with the hot, damp towel. Her mouth, she reflected, tasted as bad as she could remember anything's ever tasting. Her stomach heaved again at the thought, but she suppressed the sensation sternly. Muscles hovered on the brink of revolt for a few precarious seconds, then subsided, for the moment at least. "Betta?" a voice asked, and she looked up from the basin in her lap with a wan smile. Despite both the fire crackling behind her husband and the embedded tile pipes circulating heated water under the bedroom's tile floor, the air was chilly, to say the least, and the fresh towel he'd just taken from the kettle on the bedroom hearth steamed in his hand. Under the circumstances, it was understandable that the Emperor had wrapped a blanket around himself as he stood beside their bed, however unregal he might look at the moment. In fact, Charlian was of the opinion that it went beyond unregal to something approaching silly. "On the other hand," she thought, "he did climb out of bed and hand me a towel the instant he heard me throwing up. That's got to count for something, even if the whole thing is his fault." "Better, I think," she said, adding the conditional when her stomach gave another tentative heave. "Good." He whisked the towel with which she'd wiped her face, and which had already cooled markedly, out of her hand and replaced it with the one he'd just wrung out. The used towel went back into the kettle, and he carried the basin into the adjacent bathroom. A moment later, she heard the toilet flush. Then he returned, setting the basin carefully on the bedside table beside her, before he climbed back into the bed himself and wrapped his arms around her. "Ow!" she objected, as cold feet wiggled their way under her. "Well, Caleb Jean Harald Brian Armach, Duke of Armach, Prince of Telesburg, Prince Protector of the Realm, King of Karras, and, by God's grace, Emperor of Karras, said reasonably to Charlian Alana Jennifer Alyssa Tate Armach, Duchess of Cherraith, Lady Protector of Chisholm, Queen of Chisholm, and, by God's grace, Empress of Karras. They got frozen in your service. The least you can do is help me thaw them out again. And if the shock of being poked with two lumps of ice makes me throw up again?" she inquired darkly.
At the rate you're throwing up, whether I poke you with ice or not isn't going to make any difference, he told her philosophically. Besides, you're facing the other way. Some things could not be allowed to pass by any self-respecting empress, and Caleb squawked as she whipped around and slender, vengeful fingers found his armpits. In one of the universe's less fair dispensations, he was far more ticklish than she was, and she pressed her despicable advantage ruthlessly. All right, he gasped finally. I surrender. I'll thaw my own feet out, you ungrateful and unreasonable wench.
Oh, wench is it, she retorted, and he shouted with laughter as she redoubled her attack. Then he rolled back over, caught her wrists, and pinned them down. She started to wiggle, only to stop as he bent over her and kissed her forehead.
But you're my very most favorite wench in all the world, he told her softly, and she shook her head with a smile.
You really need to work on your technique, Your Majesty, she told him. On the other hand, considering the source, and the fact that that's probably the very best your poor primitive male brain can do, I accept your apology.
Apology? He quirked one eyebrow. I don't remember making any She smacked her hip into him sideways, and he paused in mid-word, his expression thoughtful. What I meant to say, he corrected himself in a dignified tone, was that I'm gratified, deeply gratified, by your forgiveness.
Which is why you'll live to see another dawn, she told him sweetly.
A consideration which did cross my own mind, he conceded, and gave her forehead another kiss before he settled back. Given the way her own mouth tasted, she couldn't fault his kiss's placement, she admitted, as his right arm went back under and around her, and he drew her head down on his right shoulder. She nestled close, treasuring the warmth of their blankets, inhaling the smell of him, and he raised his arm behind her in a hug, which happened to let his right hand caress her hair.
Seriously, he said, how long do you expect this to go on?
Too long, however long it is, she said darkly, then shrugged. I'm not sure. Mother says she was never morning sick at all, and neither was Grandmama, as far as Mother recalls, so that's no help. Or particularly fair, now that I think about it. And according to Sarai, her mother was morning sick for at least 10 months. Or was it an entire year? 2 years?
The Empress shrugged again.
Something like that, anyway.
She grimaced fondly, and Caleb chuckled in sympathy. Sarai Hallman had been Charlian's personal maid since she'd been a little girl, and she seemed to be enjoying the present moment rather more than the Empress was. She was certainly hovering for all she was worth, and no matter what Father Dirac, the palace healer, might say, Sarai could be relied upon to think of one of her innumerable female ancestors who had experienced the same problem, only incomparably worse. No doubt she fondly imagined she was reassuring her charge by telling her how lucky she was that things were so much less bad than they could have been. Or something.
Well, maybe Merlin can give us an estimate, Caleb said.
Maybe. Charlian knew her tone sounded a bit tentative, but she also figured she was entitled to at least a little anxiety, given the nature of her projected itinerary.
Nervous? Caleb asked gently, as if he'd just read her mind.
Not that it would have required any esoteric talent to be able to figure out exactly what she'd been thinking.
A little, she admitted, nestling more comfortably against him. It's not something I've ever done before, after all.
Well, I've only done it twice myself. Once, really, if you're talking about round trips, Caleb said. On the other hand, Merlin's done it a lot. Of course, he didn't take me out of atmosphere. The Emperor pouted for a moment. But he didn't have as far to go then as he does this time. And if he's confident his stealth systems are up to the trip, I'm not going to argue with him.
Very big of you, since you're not the one making this particular trip, she pointed out dryly.
No, I'm not, he agreed. In fact, I wish I were.
He hugged her more tightly against himself for just a moment.
Still, given that he can only fit in one passenger, I think you may actually be a better choice for this first trip than I'd be in some ways. And I know Father Dirac says everything is just fine, that all this morning sickness is perfectly natural, but I'll still feel better having Owl say the same thing.
Me too, she acknowledged, then giggled just a little nervously against his shoulder. Still, it does feel a bit strange to be talking about getting a machine's opinion.
Just strange? Caleb asked softly.
All right, she said after a moment, her own voice more serious. I'll admit it worries me a little too, I can't help that. I know up here, she raised one hand to tap her temple, that everything the church ever taught us is a lie. I know that, and I truly believe it. But I was still raised a daughter of Mother Church, Caleb. Somewhere down inside, there's that little girl reciting her catechism, who can't help being a little scared when she thinks about walking into the very lair of Shan Wei herself. I know it's silly, but...
She let her voice trail off, and his arm tightened around her.
I don't think it's silly at all, he told her. It's been less than 5 months since you found out about Merlin and all the rest of it. As a matter of fact, I think that's one reason you make a better choice than I do just now. After all, I've had a lot longer than you have to adjust, as much as anyone can, at least. Although I'd be lying if I said I don't still have my own worried moments. And I understand exactly what you mean. It's not a matter of having doubts, just a matter of realizing how completely and totally you've broken with everything you were brought up knowing you were supposed to believe. On the other hand, I've found it helps to ask myself if someone like the Archangel Langhorn is supposed to have been would ever have let someone like the Group of Four take over his church if he actually existed.
There's that, Charlian agreed grimly. Caleb was right, she thought. And as he'd said, it wasn't that she had any doubts about the truthfulness of everything Merlin Athrawes had told them either. On the other hand, the occasional spasms of deeply programmed anxiety she felt left her less than totally confident about how the rest of the planet Safehold's population was going to react when the time finally came to reveal the full truth about the Church of God awaiting. It was going to be ugly, at the very least, and deep inside, she felt sinkingly certain it would turn out to be much worse than that in the end. It couldn't be any other way, really. Not when every human being on the entire planet had been taught the same things she'd been taught, believed the same things she'd always believed in the Holy Writ's version of God's plan for Safehold, and in the testimony's description of the day of creation. And how could they not believe those things? The Adams and Eves who'd written those testimonies had told the absolute truth as far as they knew it. Of course, they hadn't known their memories had been altered during their long cryonic journey. She still had trouble understanding how that bit had worked, from a doomed planet called Earth to their new home. They hadn't known the archangels, who'd appeared to them in human form as God's messengers and deputies, had actually been members of the colonizing expedition's command crew. And they hadn't known the Archangel Langhorn and the Archangel Bedard had deliberately and cold-bloodedly murdered Dr. Pei Shanwei and everyone else who disagreed with Langhorn's plan to lock Safehold into a pre-technical civilization forever. So it wasn't a bit surprising that their totally accurate accounts of what they had seen and experienced, thought and felt, after awakening here on Safehold, should be so damnably consistent and convincing. Worse, there were literally millions of them, and not one of them disputed the church's official version.
Well, maybe one of them did, she reminded herself, thinking of the Journal of Saint Journaux. It wasn't part of the official testimonies, and there was no question in her mind what the Inquisition would do if it should ever discover that journal's existence. But Saint Journaux, Jeremiah Knowles, had also been an Adam, and his version of events didn't agree with the writ, the testimonies, or Mother Church herself. Of course, that was because he'd been part of Pei Shan Wei's Alexandria enclave. He'd known the truth about Safehold, about the genocidal Gababa, who had destroyed something called the Terran Federation and driven this last remnant of the human race into hiding. He'd known what was supposed to happen here on Safehold, known the mission planners had never intended for all memory of the Gababa to be lost, that they'd recognized that sooner or later, mankind and the Gababa would meet again, and that while it was essential for humanity to temporarily abandon technology, while it hid among the trackless stars, it was just as essential for that technology to reemerge once more in the fullness of time. And it was for knowing that truth, for refusing to abandon that truth, that Pei Shan Wei and every other living soul in the Alexandria Enclave had been slaughtered by Langhorne's Rakurai, the cataclysmic kinetic bombardment which had transformed Alexandria into the officially damned and accursed Armageddon Reef. But Knowles, his wife, and his brother-in-law and sister-in-law had survived, hidden away in a tiny colony settlement called Telesburg, which would one day become the capital of the Kingdom of Karis. They'd written their own testimony, their history of what had really happened, and hidden it, hoping that when it was rediscovered centuries later, someone would be willing to recognize the truth when he finally saw it. Someone had been, and the Brethren of Saint Journaux had guarded that knowledge for over 400 years, passing it on, nurturing it in secret, working by gradual degrees to undermine the crushing political and spiritual tyranny of the church Langhorne and Bedard had created. There'd never been many of them, and they'd always had to be insanely cautious, yet they'd never given up. The fact that they'd believed Knowles' journal when they read it still awed Charlian in many ways. The intellectual and spiritual integrity it had taken to accept that lone voice of dissent was staggering whenever she thought about it. She hoped she would have been able to do the same thing, yet deep inside she doubted it. Put her faith in a single voice of protest, however passionate, rather than the massed testimony of 8 million other Adams and Eves? Accept the word of someone who died almost 700 years before Charlian's own birth, rather than the word of the living, breathing Church of God awaiting? Reject every single belief about the will of God she herself had been taught from girlhood? No, despite her own deep disappointment over the church's failings, despite her recognition of the degeneracy and venality of the men who controlled that church, despite her deep-seated conviction that the church had to be somehow impossibly purged of its corruption, she'd never once questioned the fundamental underlying truth she'd been taught about Langhorne and Bedard. And if she was going to be honest, she never would have if she hadn't met someone who'd been dead even longer than Jeremiah Knowles. Merlin Athrawes, Sajan Merlin, the most deadly warrior in the world, seer of visions, Caleb's protector, mentor, friend, and guide. All of those things, and also Apika, the personality-integrated cybernetic avatar, which housed the memories, hopes, and dreams of a young woman who had once been named Nemu Albin. Merlin, the one being on the planet of Safehold who knew the truth about the Terran Federation and its destruction because he had seen it with Nemu's own eyes. Because Nemu herself had died over 900 years ago,
deliberately sacrificing her life so that this planet, Safehold, might someday become not simply mankind's refuge, but the cradle of humanity's rebirth. No, I would never have believed it without Merlin, she admitted. I would have wanted to, I think, but I wouldn't have. Despite how much I love Caleb, I don't think even he could have convinced me of it. But I've got Merlin. We've got him. And given that, how could I not believe? I wish you were here, Caleb, she said now, wistfully, and heard a soft chuckle in her ear.
I wish I were too, her husband said from their bedroom in Chiraith, well over 6,000 miles away. And not just because Edward and I are going to find it a bit difficult to explain where you are if someone happens to notice you're away. The water-clear earpiece tucked into her right ear relayed his voice from the security comm she wore on a golden chain around her neck. Fortunately, a second deeper voice observed, you're one of the most talented fabricators I've ever encountered, Caleb. Any diplomat learns to lie with the best of them, Merlin, the Emperor replied. Why do I suspect that you learned to lie with the best of them, trying to explain away little things like broken windows, stolen apples, and all those other childhood infractions of which you were undoubtedly guilty? Merlin Athrawis inquired from the skimmer's forward cockpit.
Because you know him, Charlian suggested innocently.
Probably, Merlin said dryly, and Charlian chuckled.
Well, maybe the communicator is magic, she thought. But if it is, at least it's magic I've started getting used to. I wonder if I'll ever get to the point of taking it for granted the way Merlin does, though.
Sometimes she suspected she would. Other times she was positive it would never happen. It was simply too marvelous, too impossible for that. Yet there were also those moments when her own lack of familiarity with Merlin's miraculous toys actually became an advantage. The comm she wore around her neck was a case in point. It was considerably smaller than the one Merlin had originally given her, and her lips twitched in another, less crooked smile as she considered why that was. It hadn't occurred to her at first that comms could be smaller than the one he'd initially shown her. But as she'd encountered more examples of the often incredibly tiny bits and pieces of technology Merlin had shared with her and Caleb, a possibility had crossed her mind. From the beginning, she'd decided that figuring out ways to conceal things, like the communicators, had to be one of their highest priorities. Small as the original handheld units Merlin had given them might be, they were still obviously and dangerously alien-looking. They didn't belong to Safehold's homegrown and allowable technology, and anyone who saw one of them would realize that. It might not be very likely anyone ever would see one of them, but unlikely wasn't the same thing as impossible. And as Merlin himself had pointed out, if the group of four ever discovered their enemies truly were dabbling in the prescribed knowledge of Shan Wei, the consequences could be disastrous, especially if they could prove it. So she'd asked Merlin if there were smaller, even easier to hide comms tucked away in Nemu's cave. There hadn't been, but as Merlin considered her question, he'd realized there was no inherent reason he couldn't make one smaller. Most of the existing unit's size was more a consequence of having to provide something large enough for a human hand to manipulate comfortably than of any unavoidable technological constraints. The same basic capabilities could be provided by something far smaller if those manipulation requirements were removed. In fact, they had been prior to the Federation's destruction, in the form of the surgically implanted communicators the Terran military had issued to its personnel. Of course, he didn't have any of those,
and surgically installing something which would cause the eyebrows of any healer who discovered it to become permanently affixed to his hairline would probably have been a bad idea anyway. But if he had Owl redesign a comm to respond only to spoken commands, for voice activation, as he described it, even an external comm could be made little larger than the end joint of Charlian's slender thumb. Which was precisely what he'd done, using the fabrication unit in the cave where Pei Shan Wei and Commodore Pei had hidden Nemu's Pika, and all the other tools they'd provided for Merlin's use, to manufacture the new devices. Just as he'd used the same fabrication unit to hide Charlian's comm in the golden pectoral scepter she wore about her neck. Caleb wore a matching scepter. They were exact duplicates, down to the maker's stamp and the tiniest scratch of the pectorals she'd commissioned as a welcome home gift for his return from Coruscant. And they'd have to be literally smashed apart to reveal the forbidden technology concealed at their hearts. While he was at it, he'd produced yet another marvel in the form of the contact lenses Charlian wore at this very moment. At first, the thought of actually sticking something into her own eye, even something as clear and tiny as a contact lens, had been more than she was prepared to undertake. Caleb had been more adventurous, however, and his delight had been so great, Charlian had gathered her courage and taken the same plunge. She was glad she had, since the tiny lenses not only corrected the slight but irritating farsightedness, which had been growing worse over the last couple of years, but also permitted her new tiny comm to project its imagery directly onto the lenses. She could view remote imagery transmitted to her over the comm without the betraying hologram the original larger comm had produced. In fact, she and Caleb could actually view images garnered by Merlin's snarks, those self-navigating autonomous reconnaissance and communication platforms she still understood only poorly, which was actually letting them assist Merlin and the artificial intelligence called Owl in the endless struggle to cope with all the intelligence material Merlin's network of snarks made available. Merlin had followed up the same idea and provided the same ability to everyone else who'd been added to what Caleb had dubbed the Inner Circle, the list of people who knew the entire truth and had been cleared to use the comms. There weren't many of them, unfortunately, but the list was growing slowly. In some ways, that only made it more frustrating, of course. The ability to stay in close, instant communication with people literally thousands of miles away, not to mention communicating with Owl or the ability to view Merlin's visions for themselves, was an advantage whose importance would have been literally impossible to overstate. At the same time, it was something which had to be used with extraordinary care. They couldn't afford to have too many of the wrong people start wondering just exactly how it was that they managed to coordinate so perfectly over such vast distances, for example. And, in some ways, the ability to talk to some of their closest allies only made their inability to do the same thing with all of them even more incredibly frustrating. Still, stop that, Charlie, she told herself severely. You're letting your mind wander on purpose, and you know it. Which, she admitted, probably wasn't too surprising, under the circumstances. She looked ahead and saw the vast curve of Safehold stretching out before them. It was beginning to grow lighter, she realized, and felt a fresh stir of awed delight as she realized they really were catching up to the day, which had already left Chisholm so far behind. "How much longer to your cave, Merlin?" she asked, and heard his quiet, amused chuckle over the comm. Apparently, she hadn't managed to pitch her voice quite as casually as she'd intended.
"About 25 minutes, Your Majesty," he replied.
just over another 7,500 miles or so.
2. Nimue's Cave, the Mountains of Light, the Temple Lands. Charlian knew she was gaping like a child, witnessing a stage conjurer's illusions for the first time, but she couldn't help it. For that matter, she hadn't particularly cared either, as she'd watched in breathless, unalloyed delight while Merlin brought the recon skimmer down into the thicker air and bright daylight of the Mountains of Light.
Thicker air, indeed, she snorted at her own thought. You're still high enough you'd pass out almost instantly, not to mention freezing to death almost as quickly, if you weren't locked up inside Merlin's skimmer, you silly twit.
The mountain peaks reaching up toward them were crowned with thick, eternal blankets of snow. It was already high winter in these latitudes, but those mountains would have been snow-covered whatever the time of year, she thought, and adjusted the visual display, shivering inside as she gazed at their bleak, icy summits and the glaciers oozing ever so slowly down their flanks, and watched ice crystals blow on the thin winds, glittering in the bright sunlight. It was the first time she'd ever been to the continent of East Haven. In fact, it was the first time she'd ever been to the mainland at all. She'd always intended to make the pilgrimage to Zion and the Temple, just as the writ enjoined all of God's children to make it, but there'd always been too many charges on her time, too many decisions to make. Too many political crises for the first true reigning queen in Chisholm's history to deal with.
And the last thing I need is to be making any pilgrimages to the temple now, isn't it? She thought bitterly. Somehow I don't think I'd enjoy the Inquisition's greetings. On the other hand, Vicar Jaspar, the day is coming when a lot of Carisians are going to be heading for Zion, whether the Inquisition wants to see us there or not. You're sure no one's going to see us, Merlin? She asked, glancing at the secondary display that showed Merlin's face.
I'm sure, Your Majesty, Merlin replied, smiling reassuringly back at her out of the same display. Nobody really lives here, even in the summer, and the Snarks have the entire area under observation. Trust me, there's no one down there, and even if there were, I've got the skimmer in full stealth mode. We'd be invisible as far as they were concerned.
I don't mean to dither, she said half apologetically.
Your Majesty, Charlian, you're doing one hell of a lot better than I imagine I'd be doing if our positions were reversed, he assured her.
I doubt that somehow, she said dryly. It's probably just that I've learned to pretend better than you realize. I think it comes with being a queen. Marak always told me it was vital to convince people you were calm and in charge, no matter how scared you really were.
Father always told me the same thing, Caleb agreed in her ear, and she heard a sharper edge of envy in his voice.
She knew he was watching the imagery relayed from the skimmer, but she also knew that wasn't the same thing as actually being there.
And I'm probably the only person who wishes he were here more than he does.
She suppressed a nervous chuckle at the thought.
Either way, it won't be much longer, Merlin assured her. Watch.
Watch what?
Charlian began, then froze, her eyes wide, as Merlin flew straight into a sheer vertical face of stone. They weren't actually moving all that quickly, a corner of her brain realized. Certainly not compared to the velocity of their flight here, at any rate. But they were going quite fast enough for her heart to leap up into her throat. She felt herself tensing uselessly for impact, then exhaled explosively as a portal literally snapped open in front of them.
Merlin!
Sorry.
There was genuine apology in the deep voice, but there was also an undeniable edge of amusement, and Charlian made a mental note to find out whether or not it was possible to throttle a Pika.
and, for that matter, to throttle her insufferable lout of a husband, she thought, as she listened to him laughing over the comm.
"I suppose you think that was astonishingly funny, don't you, Caleb?" she inquired in a dangerously affable tone, as the skimmer swept down the center of a huge, perfectly circular, brightly lit tunnel.
"Ah, no, no, not actually," the Emperor said instantly, once again demonstrating his acumen as a tactician.
"Good," she told him. "As for you, Merlin Athrawis..."
"I know you're going to make me pay for it," he told her, "but it was worth it."
Caleb laughed again, and this time Charlian discovered she had no choice but to join him. Her pulse was decelerating towards normal once more, and she shook her head as the tunnel stretched on and on ahead of them. They were moving slowly enough now for her to see that the stone walls around them were smooth and polished, almost like mirrors, reflecting the impossibly bright glow of the endless line of overhead lights running down the center of its curved roof. There was room enough for at least half a dozen craft the skimmer's size to have passed through it abreast, and she found herself feeling very small, almost tiny, as they drifted onward through it.
"How far down does this go?" she asked.
"Well, the cave is underneath Mount Olympus," Merlin told her. "At the moment, we're still about 2 miles from the mountain itself, coming in from the north. And when we get there, we'll be just over 12,000 meters. That's about 7.5 miles down."
7.5 miles, Charlian repeated very carefully, and Merlin chuckled.
There wasn't a good deal of genuine humor in the sound, she noticed, and wondered why.
"Well, that's 7.5 miles below the summit, not below sea level," he pointed out before a reason for the pain shadowing his chuckle had occurred to her. "Still, I suppose it's deep enough to be going on with."
She sensed his shrug. "Commodore Pei and Shan Wei wanted to make certain no one would stumble across me before I woke up." Charlian started to respond, then stopped herself as she suddenly grasped the reason for the pain in his voice. It was hard for her to remember, sometimes, that people who had been dead for the better part of a millennium, as far as she was concerned, had died only a handful of years ago, as far as the man who had once been Nimue Alban was concerned. "Anyway," Merlin went on after a moment, his tone deliberately brighter, "after they tucked me away, they filled the entire complex with an inert atmosphere, which means there wasn't really anything down here that a flesh-and-blood human being could have breathed. But Al's got the environmental plant up and running, so there's going to be plenty of air when we get there."
"Well, that's a relief," Charlian said dryly, wondering exactly what an inert atmosphere was.
"We strive to please, Your Majesty," Merlin assured her. "And speaking of getting there..."
Even as he spoke, the recon skimmer slid out of the tunnel into a far vaster chamber, and Charlian inhaled sharply as still more overhead lights came on, illuminating a stupendous cavern shaped like a flattened hemisphere. Its walls curved up and inward, smooth as the tunnel had been, to join an equally smooth, flat roof a good 200 feet overhead. Yet, tall as it was much, much wider, and as the skimmer drifted out into it, she realized its vast, pavement-flat floor was crowded with dozens of devices and machines which looked at least as marvelous as the recon skimmer itself. The skimmer slid smoothly onward for another few moments, then floated smoothly into a landing beside a duplicate skimmer, nestled in the lee of another, far larger aircraft of some sort. They touched down under the sweep of an enormous wing that dwarfed their own vehicle, and as Charlian stared up at the chamber's roof, she realized the cavern was at least 1,000 yards across.
"My God," she heard herself murmur.
"What is that thing, Merlin?"
Caleb asked over the comm, and she heard the wonder in his voice as well.
Which thing? Merlin asked.
The one you just landed next to.
Oh, Merlin shrugged. That's what we call an assault shuttle, he said. Think of it as one of the landing craft we took to Coruscant, but designed to move troops from orbit down to a planetary surface.
How many troops?
Caleb's voice was suddenly more intent, more calculating, and Merlin's and Charlian's images looked at one another with matching smiles as the Emperor's military instincts engaged.
Only a couple of hundred, Merlin replied in a deliberately casual tone.
Only a couple of hundred, is it?
Caleb repeated dryly.
More or less, Merlin agreed,
and Charlian straightened as the skimmer's twin canopies opened. Cool air, fresh-smelling but with just a whisper of a stone-edged tang, flowed about her, and Merlin climbed out onto the self-extending boarding ladder and held out a hand to her. She took the hand and let him guide her down the ladder, though she was scarcely so old and feeble, or pregnant, that she needed the assistance. On the other hand, she realized, maybe she did need a little help. She was so busy gawking at all of the wonders around her that she didn't realize she'd reached the bottom of the ladder until her questing toes jarred against solid ground instead of finding the next rung, and she stumbled on the brink of falling until that hand lifted her effortlessly back upright. She gave herself a shake, then smiled at Merlin.
I'm impressed, she said.
Oh, you haven't seen anything yet, he assured her.